Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here.
My cousin Tino over here.
Welcome to Democratic Perspective on a cold and wintry day in Sedona.
It is that. It is that. It's the coldest day of the year.
And it's about as early as we ever get even little snowflakes in Sedona.
You know, I always worry about news organizations when they lead with the weather. I know it's a slow news day.
Yes. Well, it's not a slow news day. It's a confused news day.
Not that weather isn't important. Many people take weather very seriously over the age of, 60.
Yes, and when I was growing up in Oklahoma, we took weather very seriously
because
it was changing
farmers
all the time.
And old people take weather seriously. Yeah, that's true.
So what are we going to talk about today, Mike?
Well, we're going to talk about the Arizona Advocacy Network. It has such a great a melodious ring to it, the Arizona Advocacy Network. Except we don't have our caller calling in this morning. We'll probably have to reschedule. The lines may be frozen for all we know.
You said you weren't going to talk about the weather.
I'm going to talk about the weather. That's too good. It's too good a topic not to. That's why people talk about it. Skipping the Arizona Advocacy Network, which we will save for another day. We will talk about voter registration. And we will talk about mass incarceration at that time, and maybe some of the other things we think and we hope that the Arizona Advocacy Network does.
Clean
elections. That's right. What an unusual concept. Sure. Trying to get people to vote. I do want to talk about this before we might talk about France and all of that horror and how it relates to the United States and to a democratic perspective. But I was listening to Arizona Horizon. On Friday they have the journalist roundtable, and we're talking about so many independent voters in Arizona. The Morrison Institute did a study. The Cronkite School, somebody asked the Morrison Institute to do a study. And who are these people? And why are they independents? And why are, where Democrats continue to lose strength in Arizona, Republicans gain a little, and independents are fully over a third of the electorate in Arizona. And how do they define themselves? And part of the answer was that independents define themselves as neither part, as just that, independent. The suspicion is they just don't give a crap. It's not that they're right or left. They don't care what's going on. Some of the other information that came out was that a Republican who had become an independent is probably angry at the Republican Party, but still votes a little bit right. A Democrat that has become an independent is angry at both parties, but still votes a little left. But both of them use their independency, their independent status, and as an excuse not to vote. Once again, this is not exactly headline news, that both parties need to find a way to turn those independent voters out for their side. And so because of this massive independent voter block in Arizona, it makes elections really hard to predict. Unless we predict that they don't vote.
Actually, the elections are not hard to predict, unfortunately, from the Democratic perspective.
the Republicans usually win. I mean, look at Diane Douglas. I mean, you could not have had a worse candidate.
And in Garcia, you could not have had a better one.
And in David Garcia, you could not have had
a perfect candidate for superintendent of public instruction.
In Diane Douglas, you had someone who had no experience in education, really. Yeah. She had been on a school board somewhere, but that was it. And she ran against Common Core, which people are against, and they don't even know what it is.
Don't know.
And been in place for four years.
Now they're against it.
So, I guess there's a recall movement because she's gotten in fights with everybody, and she's suing everybody, and she's already cost the state hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees,
right?
From various crazy stuff she's been doing. That's kind of small potatoes, I think, compared to what's happening internationally, right?
No, well, yeah, but, you know, what do we care about? Do we care more about? I was looking at a blog, a Facebook list of comments last night on the French situation. We just moved to the French terror attacks. So many, 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 many people dead. That's the surprising part to me. We're talking
what I think
180,
is
200 people that they were successfully killed in multiple attacks. And
it's well over 100. I think the last thing I saw was something like 169.
Yeah.
And it's all sort of low tech suicide vest and AK-47s.
Yeah.
Which have been around, gosh, for 50 years.
You can get one, and you can get 10 of them in the U.S.
Yeah, you can just go buy them. And the thing is, with modern weapons, if you're attacking soft targets, if you're just killing people who are sitting out having dinner, it's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, yeah, in any free society, then that's what you're going to have.
Yeah, and so you have people spraying an outdoor cafe, and then the restaurants next to it locking the doors, and people going on the floor and climbing out the back. And then you have attack near the stadium where a guard stops a suicide bomber from getting into the stadium, thank God.
Right.
And then you have an attack on a very close venue with a lot of people in it, a sort of a concert venue. And you can see how many people they can kill in that. And they shoot all the people they can, and then they set off their suicide vest. French police don't wait around. They don't generally negotiate with these guys.
Yeah.
It's usually not very long before they catch them. But by the time they catch them, they'll have done a whole lot of damage. So this is a blow to the West. It seems to have been done by ISIS and not by Al-Qaeda. ISIS has claimed credit for it. They say they have traced telephone calls between the terrorist and and Syria.
Uh-huh.
Now, the thing about it is, if you've been to Europe recently, there are no borders anymore. When we walked from France into Spain, there's no border guards. There's no border. There's a marking that there's a border. But the border between Belgium and France and Germany and France and Belgium, it's all open now. And so the terrorists are able to move fairly freely around. The question is, what's the implications?
Let's talk about why. Yeah, that's the hard part. Everybody, the what. Thank you for the what. That was as succinct a what as I've heard. I mean, there's a lot more details, but
I think one why, which people are not talking about because they want to go to one extreme or another on this, is it ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, as the Arabs call it, has been losing in Syria and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The Kurds have taken back a major road, cutting basically ISIS's territory in two. They've taken a lot of losses.
My coffee shop guys, I argued the retaliation for the drone strike, Obama's drone strike, taking out ISIS, one of their leaders. And so this is it. They got mad. And so they did this kind of attack where it's a random suicide bombing and spraying crowds with AK-47.
I think they've been, they, they're, No one wants to say it.
Nobody likes that theory, by the way.
The administration doesn't want to emphasize it too much because they've said from the beginning this is going to be a long and bloody conflict with ISIS.
Yeah.
But they're losing ground in Syria and Iraq. They're really getting hurt. The thing about it is if you have guys like this who are one of the most murderous groups or the most murderous group anybody's ever seen, certainly in this century, running around, then they create enemies. If you intervene immediately, then people tend to stand on the sidelines. One of the tragic things is that as ISIS is beginning to create their own enemy, and they've created enemies of the Kurds, of every Shiite, of the Druze, of the Lebanese government, of the Syrian government, and the United States and its entire coalition. So when you do this kind of stuff, you go around murdering people and taking territory, you create a lot of enemies. And so now the enemies are pushing back, and the Kurds have taken back quite a bit of territory from ISIS. Now, we don't know whether that'll stand. The complexities, the political complexities of this conflict is mind-boggling. So they've been losing some ground in Syria and Iraq. Now, the way the model this is when people look at American air attacks on ISIS or ISIL, they look at a model of like bombing of Germany or something. But the air attacks, except when you have them in support of taking ground, act more like guerrilla warfare. You know, a truck disappears, a fighting position is attacked, you can't do anything about it, some guys are planning to plant a bomb and they suddenly get blown up, and so forth and so on. So what happens is there's this tremendous cumulative impact. In other words, ISIS has been taking hits for over a year now. But it doesn't destroy the organization. And normally, you know, if you're in, you know, way back, for those of us who are older, I guess we're too old, but if you can read a little bit about in history, when you have something like the Castro Revolution in Cuba, you have Batista as a corrupt government. He's weak. He doesn't have a lot of support. He has people who he pays. You know, it's kind of a kleptocracy. You know, the people who are in, and he fights a guerrilla warfare, and the guerrillas defeat him fairly easily without a lot of bloodshed. ISIS has very high morale. They have tons of foreign fighters coming in. They've only been partially stopped. And so it's a very different thing. It's going to take a very long time at this record. So when you have something like France, Mike, the impulse, I think the human impulse, whatever your politics or your religion is revenge. You know, the French bomb ISIS's capital.
Well, that's it. Those are the headlines this morning. But I want to talk about that in a second. To finish my theory that people say, well, okay, Obama takes out a ISIS leader. What's that got to do with France? Well, they could get to our allies, much easier than they can get to us. And so that was as fast a reaction as they could have done. So they took it out on France.
And also, France is the country in Europe that's most participating in our attacks in Syria and Iraq.
The headlines this morning are that France will take the lead now in the war on ISIS.
Right.
Because they have this most recent tragedy, this most recent horror, and they are prepared, at least according to the news reports, to lead the way. So the retaliation theory, we started this.
We should say that the United States has killed an awful lot of ISIS people, but it killed their leader in Libya recently in an airstrike. And that's important in this sort of horrible battle between countries. I think that one thing I want to think about, Mike, is what do you do in this kind of situation? Well, the instinct, and see if you agree with me, is to hit back, to retaliate. And
right.
Recently the United States hadn't been attacking the trucks that ISIS used to send the oil to Turkey. And the reason they hadn't done it is because the truck drivers are just guys who are hauling. They're just truck drivers. They're not ISIS guys. They're not anything. They're trying to make a living in a situation where it's almost impossible to make a living. And so they didn't attack them. They followed them and they watched them for a year or so. Today, they attacked and blew up a whole bunch of the trucks. They dropped leaflets on the trucks before they attacked. They strafed them next near them without killing anybody, and then they blew up 120 trucks or so. Now, that's an escalation. In other words, that's a willing to commit more civilian
that's
casualties.
That's a strategy Obama has that everybody accuses him of not having.
Right. And then the thing with what the French did was they bombed the capital of ISIS. Now, when you do that, you're going to kill more civilians. And probably the United States and other things have been very reluctant. Because when you start killing civilians, you start making enemies. You make enemies just like ISIS has made a lot of enemies.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole, not sure I can pronounce it right, the Yazidi battalion now. Mm. Remember what they did to those people. They're ancient people, ancient religion. It's not really connected to any of our modern religion. They lived peacefully in that area for thousands of years. And ISIS took over, murdered a whole bunch of them, drove them up into the mountains where they were starving. That's how we got involved in this. And took their women as sex slaves.
Right.
And now they're coming back to get revenge on ISIS.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I don't know how this plays itself out, Mike, but the logic, so the pressure now on the United States' as allies is to conduct raids that are caused many more civilian casualties to get even with ISIS.
Well, that's it. I was, to get back to the French thing, the BBC did a nice comparison of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and drawing a distinction where some people don't think there is one, but certainly the BBC does, and I do too, at least the spokesman does. And that is, if Al-Qaeda had attempted the French terror attacks, those multiple attacks a few days ago, the scenario would not have been so bloody or so successful. Their attempts in the past were either foiled by local authorities, whether it was French or U.S. or wherever. So this is an escalation of boldness, of firepower, of success. These guys pulled it off. These guys got in. They did. Remember, it's a lot harder to have a Kalashnikov in France than it is in the United States.
They seem to have been smuggled in from the Balkans.
Well, that's it.
They managed to get them in.
And they didn't get caught. And that was the whole point of the BBC.
They caught one guy in Germany with a whole bunch of them, but they didn't connect it with the attack.
Right.
The attack then happened, I think, the next day. And so it didn't get connected. Al-Qaeda was set up to attack the West for perceived Western attacks on Islam, Islamic culture, and people.
Mm.
It was set up to attack people like us.
Right.
ISIS was set up more to take territory. And now what we see, if this is ISIS, and that seems to be the way that everybody's pointing, if this is ISIS, then ISIS is now not only doing the stuff that ISIS traditionally did,
right,
but now does the sort of stuff that Al-Qaeda did, if they're doing it, with the exception of 9/11, better.
Right.
So that's a change, because now they've decided, and I think it's in part because they're taking an awful lot of casualties where they are. It doesn't show, and people don't talk about it, but they're taking a lot of casualties, and so they're trying to strike back. The French were part of a coalition, a major
right.
European part of the coalition, so they're attacking France. Plus, you know, go on, Mike. Yeah.
I at my house last night, I had a gentleman from Germany and a woman from Holland, and they gave their perspective on the French thing. And part of what they believe is what the GOP believes, that Obama is a wishy-washy leader without a strategy. I think we are seeing in the last couple of weeks, and certainly in the next, in the last couple of days, a clear strategy of involving all of the key players: Turkey, the Kurds, disaffected Iraqis, Iran, and so on. They also believed, and we're going to get to my election theory in a second that you rolled your eyes at before the show, but we're going to get to the fact that France is in the middle of election, and then things, weird things happen in elections. They believe that the Saudis want to create a Sunni state, a Sunni caliphate, and ISIS is their tool to do that. And so that's why
I think that's way off base. I mean, what the Saudis did that was really terrible was build all these mosques with extremist leadership. And so you have the area in Belgium where some of the terrorists seem to have come from. And at one time it was mostly Moroccan folks I believe Turkish people there, and the mosques were very moderate and weren't really political. And you had the Saudis come in and build these mosques for their particularly extreme version of Islam. Now, the Saudi version of Islam, or Salafism, which is the real extreme sort of fundamentalist Islam, very narrow interpretations of the Quran. The Quran, like a lot of sacred books, has lots of contradictions in it, lots of moods and stories. Their creation of Salafists, and in Saudi Arabia, they're loyal to the king and the kingdom. In other words, they thought they were creating very conservative people, a compromise for them politically, to a very conservative Islam where everybody prays six times a day, does all this sort of stuff. But what happened is they got out of control, and the people that they created. I mean, this has happened to us a whole lot of times. You create something that you lose control over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the Saudis lost control of what they had started to do. And now they've tried to take it back, but it makes them look complicit. And in a way, they are complicit by spreading a religion that went from being, I forgot the term, Mike, but it was originally Salafism was sort of pietist and quiet. They didn't do anything much except do religion.
Yeah.
And then, thanks to Osama bin Laden and crew, it got politicized.
Right.
And so you have that as a serious danger. It looks to me that what they're doing is recruiting young people. And some of them come from middle-class families.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them come from very, very poor families. Immigrants have a hard time adjusting to countries. Often the parents are working so hard and in such difficulties that the kids are let run loose without a lot of values.
Yeah.
So I think horrible as it is, the foreign recruits for ISIS see meaning. What they're looking for is meaning in their lives. They're raised in Western society, some of them, where there is no meaning. If you're not going to go to the top of a Western society, what are you going to do? I mean, if you're not going to be a computer programmer and make a bunch of money, or you don't have a really good job somewhere, or you don't have a family, most of these people don't have families, then what are you going to do? What's the meaning of your life? And Western materialism, or any materialism, really doesn't answer that. And so, horrible as it seems, ISIS seems to do it. It offers you a new life. It offers you a new identity of who you are.
You bet.
And it offers you clear enemies, and it offers you a program. The program is murderous and violent,
yeah.
But murderous, violent programs have been used to recruit people for ages. So if you're a young person and you see ISIS, one of the strategies I think that Obama has done well is you needed to break the sense of ISIS that it was invincible.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, you had to hurt them bad enough so the sense of invincibility. Because otherwise, you know, even if you're a young woman, you think, well, you know, I don't know where I'm going in society. Mm-hmm. I can go over there. I'll have a husband. I'll have a job. Yeah. They'll find a place for me. We will fight the bad guys, which unfortunately is almost everyone in the world, whether you're Muslim or Christian or Druze or, you know, whatever you are, they pretty much hate everybody. But so what we think logically is that should stop people from being recruited by ISIS. In other words, we think these are the most terrible people in the world, and that should stop them. But look how often human beings overlook the damage and cruelty of what they do in the name of religion or triumph, you know. I mean, you don't have to look far. We have Nazis. We had, frankly, the Crusades, which started in France a lot against other French people who had a different idea about religion. And then they spread to the Islamic world. So ISIS offers young people, and it's a very small group of young, most Muslim converts, a meaningful life of terrorism and control their own country, their own rules.
Sure.
They become bosses. They get given sex slaves.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a horrible, it's like a horrible computer game where you accumulate stuff, and it appeals to a tiny section.
Well, those
a tiny section can do a lot of damage.
Well, those are the two things. First of all, getting back to the French thing, one of the things we want to pay attention to is exactly what you said. But in this case, what could hurt us the most and what could hurt France and Europe the most are those that went to hang out with ISIS and came back. In Europe, it's thousands. They talked about 1,200 in France alone, thousands all over the continent. In the U.S., it's 40. And the State Department is keeping track of those 40. But just like the French authorities and the other European authorities were keeping track of their thousands, but just by sheer numbers, as is coming out now, a lot, as you said at the top of the show, a lot of people had known about some of the French attackers, but they went on and off the radar.
Like the last attack in France, they may know these guys are potential terrorists, Mike, but they haven't done anything. In our legal system, France has a much tougher legal system than the United States in terms of dealing with criminals. But we don't punish people before they've done anything. And I don't, many of those people are French citizens. They can't be just deported.
That was Mission Impossible 1. We have the pre-crime, at that. Anyway.
It is like that science fiction movie. You can know these guys. But then, you know, there's 1,200 of them, and 12 of them actually go violent. You know what I mean? It's a very difficult problem, and, you know, I think the French police are very good, and they completely failed.
Well,
that's
the other thing I have
this morning. French intelligence agencies collapsed.
I agree. I don't think there's anything, you know, we are proud of our legal organizations, the many, many that we have, FBI, CIA, the NSA, and all of their minions. But we do want to be careful. The only other thing I want to say on the air is being careful of your sources. Spread your news sources around. Don't rely, believe me, don't rely on network news and don't rely on Fox News at all. There are many, we all have the same news sources available to us today with, if you're online at all. Please, 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 please get, if you're going to look at global issues, get a global perspective from the BBC or Al Jazeera or the Salon or Wired or any even our New York Times and Washington Post.
So,
but other than those sources,
you brought up earlier is we can. There's a long article by Anonymous in the New York Review of Books, and basically, it's one of those articles that sounds very, very smart, but the guy does not want to understand what's happening. It's like, this doesn't explain everything, so it's not part of the explanation. This looking for a singular explanation is difficult for something like ISIS that is so terrible from the outside. But from the inside, it creates an insider-outsider. And all these cults we've seen,
yeah,
you have this thing.
That's
now,
true.
Where does ISIS come from? Well, it comes from Iraq. These are a lot former Saddam Hussein military people. They were trained. They fought you think Iraqis were no good at fighting, but they fought a long, long war with Iran. So they were trained and they were experienced soldiers. And the first thing the U.S. did was fire them all and take away their source of living. And they got into an insurgency. And the solution, I believe it was about 170,000 Americans, something like that, in Iraq was the surge. Okay. Now everybody's saying, well, the surge should have worked, but it didn't. But it never was going to work. What the surge did was destroy large units of al-Qaeda and the resistance in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They could not form a strong unit. It killed off the leadership. We decapitated the leadership.
Right.
And what happened, rising from this, these people were never really defeated. In fact, everybody's saying, well, they recovered quicker than we thought we would. From my point of view, I always thought they would recover, and they recovered much more slowly than I thought. I never thought the surge was going to work as a deep solution because the guys are still there.
Right.
And so what they came, the new iteration, the new thing that emerged was ISIS, and they emerged with much better, much more original leadership with a different strategy, which was to take territory in the chaos of Syria. They didn't start out taking territory in Iraq. They started taking territory in Syria, which was divided into, I mean, guys, look at the maps in some of the papers and,
yeah,
I mean, the number of different groups fighting each other, Mike, is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, we can't. You're right. One of the best things I like going around the internet are is that, and it shows this group of Syrian refugees walking through the desert. These people didn't create ISIS, and then it has a picture of Dick Cheney and George Bush. These people created, we created ISIS. These people didn't create ISIS, not the Syrian refugees. They didn't somehow morph into this well-financed, well-armed terror organization. They became what they are today.
Here's what we have to think about.
The route, the direction that you just mentioned.
Right, Mike. Here's what we have to think about, and it's a very difficult thing for both liberals and conservatives. If you want to think honestly about it, it's a very difficult situation. When Saddam Hussein was in power, we didn't have any of this.
Right.
If Assad had stayed in power solidly, we wouldn't have any of this.
True.
And look at Libya. We managed to get rid of Gaddafi, who was a crazy madman, a terrible dictator, at almost no cost to the United States, no cost in lives, almost no cost in money. And then what did we end up in Libya? We ended up with the same chaos, which is actually harder on the people who live there. Now, the Syrian civil war has morphed into this giant. Many of these people are from Iraq. I mean, people are fleeing for their lives.
Well, that's the other headline.
I don't know what you do, but we have to look honestly at the fact that taking out these dictators, when it's done by us from the outside, without it emerging organically from a revolt or a revolution internally,
exactly.
When that happens, the revolutionaries don't take over. We take over and we pick guys that we think are good guys, and they turn out to be not so good guys. And we're talking about Afghanistan. Karzai, incompetent leadership. We're talking about Iraq, Maliki, competent leadership. They were all put there by us. They were installed by us. They didn't grow out of any kind of natural structure of the country. And when you do that, when you just go in and break a whole bunch of things, same thing in Libya. We break a bunch of things. It's not emerging organically from the country. And so you don't get anyone there to replace it.
Well, that's true. and then once again, a great analysis. The other headlines that you're seeing this morning are the pressure now for a Syrian political settlement. Because everybody, or the powers that be, see the same thing you see, that had the unrest in Syria, and unrest is way too small a word, but it's what
Civil
I'm
war.
What I'm using this morning. The unrest in Syria is so key to all of this that as they put back whatever they're going to put back, political settlement is first. So you got Putin and Obama, you know, meeting during the G20 on their own. Usually they release pictures of them sitting there with their aides, you know, four or five of them around the table with the topic of political settlement in Syria.
That's been a sticking point for this whole thing. I think it's looking bad enough that pretty much everybody thinks there should be a political settlement. The problem from the beginning is that underneath what was originally a sort of civil rights demonstrations against Assad, who's a rotten dictator, turned immediately into Sunnis against all the Syrian minorities. And so the reason that Assad is able to hold on so long is that he has support from his particular religious group,
sure,
from other Shiites, yeah, from Christians originally supported Assad, and the Druze and a whole lot of other people. So he had support from minority groups who are afraid of the kind of thing you see with ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And that's kept this thing going on and on and on.
Well, that's it. I mean, we, you know, I mean, we have this stable government, and it makes it the world, at least the U.S., safe for capitalism, and so lots of companies make lots of money. It's one of my problems with companies that don't pay taxes. We keep you nice and safe here, and we keep people from. We have this stable political situation, so you can make tons of money.
In fact, the United States is supporting dictators all over the world.
Well, it gives us money. We take your tax money and support dictators rather than send,
and they keep the people down, and we get to do our economic thing.
Rather than send kids to college and make more money for our companies, our corporations that don't pay taxes.
But we should get to one thing you mentioned earlier, Mike, and I don't know if we got it out clearly, which is the political implications.
The French election.
Of the French
election. Even though my angry Arizona. I told you I was sitting with the gentleman from Germany, the Dutch woman, who both gave what I think is a pretty good European perspective. But I was also sitting with later my Arizona angry libertarian, I'm going to call him, and he believes without a doubt that this is the work of the French. Because they're in the middle of election, and you have a candidate who wants to close borders, who is extreme right wing, and doesn't want to hear about Syrian refugees, wants to stop that all of that.
That's true all over Europe. And see I mean, let's be honest. Europe is under tremendous pressure with all these refugees. There are millions of them. It's not an easy problem to deal with. They're fleeing legitimately terrible situations. They're arriving in Europe when Europe has not recovered as well as the United States has from the Great Recession. Their policies were very much, despite everybody calling them socialist, were very much like what the Republicans advocated here of cutting spending, and it's kept them from their economies from reviving. So their economies are in difficulty. They're having trouble absorbing refugees already, and then we have millions of people heading across borders, and clearly or maybe unclearly, ISIS is able to infiltrate it. So you have 2 million refugees, and they've got five guys in the 2 million refugees. France is run by a government mildly socialist, or we would call it, especially something like the
Hollande.
By Hollande, and the main opposition is by Le Pen, which is a National Front. National Front started out as a neo-fascist organization, anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-everybody.
Nice to call them neo-fascist when fascist will do.
Yeah. So, they've moderated in time. I mean, the daughter of the founder of the National Front threw her own father out of it because he says such incredibly vicious and nasty stuff. He threw him out of the movement. She's trying to clean up the National Front so it'll look like a respectable player.
Does Trump have a daughter that could throw him out?
Probably, but
I hope so.
So the fear is this is going to enable not only in France, but mostly in France, the far-right anti-immigration people that are all over Europe. There's a strong group in Netherlands. There are groups in Germany. There's a neo-fascist Europe group, I believe, that is, I may be wrong about that, folks, but I believe it's had very large demonstrations. And I'm not sure it's quite fair to call them neo-fascists, but they're very far-right-wing guys.
Yeah.
And so there are these anti-immigrant groups all over Europe. And there is a real problem. It's millions of people, and so it's not an easy thing. United States is what we've taken about 5,000. We've taken very few Syrian refugees. We spend year vetting each one of them.
And you see once again on the internet, some of the comment section that I went through in the last 24 hours.
So what's going to happen here is people are going to say no Syrian refugees.
Comment after comment after comment.
We're only going to take Christian Syrian refugees, according to one of the younger Bushes.
Yeah. A lot of
anti-Syrian
refugees.
And we've had like the John Birch Society and right-wing extremists. There's an area, I believe it, in on the East Coast, in the Mid Coast, and I think it's in North Carolina. And they started this campaign about Syrian refugees are going to be settled here and stuff. Or you've got to watch out for the Syrian problem here in this little town. And guess how many Syrian refugees there were in the area? None.
Yes, like the Ebola crisis.
The potential of hysteria, and we saw this with the National Monument fight here.
Yes.
The potential for hysteria and misinformation and lies and fear to overrun things. And I don't know what you do in this situation. A lot of what we're seeing is blowback from bad United States policy.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean you can not deal with these terrorists on something like their own terms. You cannot allow something like ISIS, I don't think, and I'm pretty much on the avoiding war. Once it's gotten going, you can't allow it to be successful. So what the Obama administration has basically done has been running guerrilla warfare against ISIS, trying to break their spirit, trying to cut their expansion, and all that has worked. And then we have ISIS response is to send out groups to strike back to deny what's happening.
Let's cut it off there for a second. That's a good segue into the Democrats of the Red Rocks are having their breakfast this Thursday. One of our supporters here on Democratic Perspective, Democrats of the Red Rocks are supporting. Are having a breakfast, and we have Sheila Healey coming from the Arizona Democratic Party.
She's the executive director of the Arizona Democratic Party.
We're going to have her on the show?
We're going to try to have her on the show.
All right.
Next Monday. I have not been able to get it set, Mike, but that's the aim, is to have her on the show next Monday and do a pre-recording.
She is young and informed and,
from Texas.
And, from Texas. I didn't know that.
Probably seems liberal here, you know.
And so she is the executive director of the Democratic Party. She'll be speaking right here in Sedona at 8 o'clock at the old Sedona establishment.
Bar and Grill.
I guess we can say Bar and Grill. Go check her out.
Great breakfast and great speakers.
Great breakfast, great speaker. It ought to be interesting. For those of you that, for those of us, I should say, that aren't too sure the direction Arizona's going, certainly educationally, this the $3.5 billion is a joke, and I think we'll talk about that next show. It's too little, too late, but it's hard to say things against money for education, which is what Ducey and his minions have forced the AEA and other people into.
Yeah, the key here is to be flexible.
Too little, too late. So let's don't forget you can catch this show on VVID.org. VVID.org is our website. You find a great little summary and a lot of our past shows. Thank you. We'll see you next week with another Democratic Perspective.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.